Murder in the heart and judging or judge. Brother Dale pointed out from the writings of Brother Grocott, he says that the chapters 5 to 7, the Sermon on the Mount, as we call it, are the living and vital heart of the truth. And the sermon, I think he says in that same exhortation, contains 40 commands in total. I haven't actually gone through them to prove that myself, but I'll take his word for it. The Sermon on the Mount, through these three chapters, contains 40 commands. And we are acutely aware of the words of Christ in John chapter 15, where he said, "Ye are my friends if ye do whatsoever I command you." So we are only his friends if we do whatsoever he commands us. And obviously 40 being a number of probation, we see that these commands are paramount in our probationary time in this barren wilderness which we live. We seal our fate if we take these chapters lightly. They are especially potent to us because I think it's true to say that none of us here would ever dream of breaking any of the Ten Commandments as a rule of thumb. I can hardly see any one of us turning around and stabbing our brethren or getting some wood carving tools, making an idol and bowing down to it. But we have to ask the question that is this, if I can call it, default program within us pleasing to God? Because to be fair, most of us have had sound parenting. And we've been brought up not to accept these things. But this is kind of an automatic morality, if we can call it that, which is not a bad thing. It indicates that our upbringing and our influences have been good. But Brother Robert says that the law of Christ lives the matter a stage higher and kills disobedience in its very inception. So in these chapters that we are looking at, we're not just looking at the act itself. We're not just looking at some of these basic things, because the Ten Commandments given under the law were basic. We're not just looking at those in the abstract form or on the surface of things. The law of Christ takes the matter right to the very inception of sin. And suddenly, the moral high ground we can so often think we are on disappears. Because if we take these issues far beyond the act itself, we may find that it penetrates beyond our masks and explores what is really beneath. Brother Brian read chapter 5, which forms the first part of this address, which is split into two parts, murder in the heart being the first. Matthew chapter 5, verse 21. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Without saying anything on these verses yet, can I refer you to John chapter 8 and verse 44. The Gospel record of John, chapter 8, and verse 44. Christ addressing the scribes and Pharisees who were obviously his arch enemies, not because of anything that he did, but because he spoke the words of truth. Ye are of your father the devil, he says, and the lusts of your father ye will do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar, and the father of it. This is the serpent thinking. He is referring to the time when the serpent deceived Adam and Eve in the garden. So how was the serpent a murderer? He wasn't a murderer because he sought to slay Adam and Eve. But he speculated in a fashion with a way of thinking that contradicted the law of God. And therefore, while he did not mean to tell a lie, he did. And therefore he was a liar. He did not mean to kill Adam and Eve. But by the results of his reasoning and belief on the part of Adam and Eve, he did cause them to die, and therefore he was a murderer. Why I've turned here is not to show that the way of the serpent is the way that we can behave necessarily, but it teaches that murder has its origins not in the act, but in the thoughts and the intents of the heart. We may not be serpents, but similar reasoning, whatever reasoning it is, if it is not the reasoning of the Spirit word, can result in acts which would be murder, even if we never commit them. Genesis chapter 4, verse 5, takes us to the next incident where real murder did take place. And to Cain and to his offering, he that God had not respect. And Cain was wroth, and his countenance fell. And Yahweh said unto Cain, Why art thou wroth? And why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, a sin offering lieth at the door. So we read that Cain was wroth. Did anything good come from Cain's wrath or his anger? Obviously not. Christ said, There is nothing from without a man that entering into him can defile him, but the things which come out of him, those are they that defile a man. Brother Thomas says regarding Cain, Self-condemned and impotent, he vented his rage against his brother, whom God respected and accepted. He was wroth against him, because his own works were evil, and his brother's righteous. He was now a murderer in principle. So before he actually carried out the act, he was a murderer in principle, indicating that the problem lay in the heart of Cain, not in his hand, which took the knife or whatever he did. The murder lay in his heart. He was a murderer in principle. He hated his brother. He allowed those feelings to ferment and ultimately carried out the act that unfortunately is dormant in us all, but which in Cain erupted into fratricide. But even this is not really touching the depths of Christ's words. I, speaking for myself, and I'm sure everybody else can say amen to these words, I have no feelings toward anyone that could cause me to want to kill them. But Christ's law touches issues even deeper than this. It prevents this form of Pharisaism where we might be able to say, because I've never killed anybody, therefore I'm not a murderer. Christ, in the commands in Matthew chapter 5, commands us to subdue all such feelings long before they have ended in such huge crimes. And hence, to hate a brother in any form is akin to murdering him. Why? Because they're the same feelings that Cain had, even if they're not carried to the ultimate outworking. Every saying of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount leads back to the springs of action in the heart. Therefore, it is the principle of Christ that the disposition, our disposition, is what leads to our actions. Murder, therefore, begins not with the thought of murder, but with any form of uncharitable thinking. And Brother Roberts says in the Law of Moses, under the law of Christ, anger becomes the crime that killing was under the law of Moses. It is the angry mind that comes under judgment. And Jesus assumes that the anger is of a kind which betrays the absence of love. And therefore, however incipiently, whatever the magnitude of it, the presence of hate. In those verses in Matthew chapter 5, we read that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. But the Revised Version and the Diaglot omit these words, without a cause. And if these renderings are correct, we can only conclude that there is never any cause for anger. Whosoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of the judgment. It is evident, I believe, brethren and sisters, that these things are directed at us in view of the naturally thin-skinned, selfish beings we essentially are. Because at the end of the day, what causes anger? It is nearly always something that has invaded our self-interest, if we might say so. It is something that has either hurt us, perhaps makes us envious of others. That was the case with Cain. Or maybe just even challenges our views on matters. Sometimes we can have long-held beliefs, and someone can challenge that, and automatically there's a barrier or feelings of resentment toward that person. the obvious answer to this question, can anything good come from such feelings? Obviously not. Now at the same time, we read of Yahweh being angry, such as with the children of Israel in the wilderness. In Deuteronomy chapter 9, we read in Horeb, he provoked Yahweh to wrath, so that Yahweh was angry with you. Likewise in Psalm 7, we read, God is angry with the wicked every day. But let us never forget, God is not like us. He is not governed by flesh thinking, but by spirit thinking. The flesh lusteth against the spirit. The natural tendencies of God are always righteousness. Our natural tendencies are opposed to the thinking of God. And thus anything that is natural to us must be suppressed. And therefore anger itself must be suppressed. The word angry in the Greek is the word orgizo, from orgy. I'm guessing that we get our word orgy from these words, and signifies a violent passion. If we read verse 23 and 24, I think these prove that it does not have to have a violent outworking. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, says Christ, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. These sort of clarify the kind of situation that Christ is thinking of when he's delivering his sermon. Like we say, the violence does not have to have an outworking. The violence can be pent up within us, like a burning flame consuming us away. The seriousness of anger is revealed to us in several places. I'm going to turn to some of these now. Proverbs chapter 14 is one, verse 17. He that is soon angry dealeth foolishly, and the man of wicked devices is hated. Proverbs chapter 22. And verse 24, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man thou shalt not go. That really does put it onto quite a high level. Make no friendship with an angry man. I think that really drives home the seriousness of it. And Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 9. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. And Titus chapter 1 verse 7. Titus chapter 1 verse 7. For a bishop must be blameless as the steward of God, not self-willed, not soon angry, not given to wine, nor striker, not given to filthy lucre. Some render that not angry rather than not soon angry. So again, can we be angry at all? And James chapter 4 verse 2 is the last I have here, and there are others. James chapter 4 verse 2, ye lust, I read verse 1, from whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members? Ye lust and have not, ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because ye ask not. Now, we don't read the word anger here, but I believe it's an echo of the same principle. Truly, James was not writing to believers who were literally killing. Ye fight and war, and ye have not, because ye ask not. I believe that James is actually reflecting the words of Christ here. When he refers to killing, he's not referring to literally killing brethren, killing brethren. He's referring to the words of Christ of anger and wrath between brethren and sisters. And I think James possibly might have the words of the Sermon on the Mount in mind here. At the same time, is there such a thing as righteous anger? And I know this is a question which has been bandied about between brethren and sisters many times. I'm not going to give a definite answer to that, because I don't really have one. But I certainly think it's worth pointing out that we need to be very, very, very careful when we, if we think we can't have righteous anger. Certainly, it's difficult not to be angry with such systems as the Roman Catholic system, which is abhorrent, blasphemous, and murderous. But at the same time, we are very much in danger of allowing anger to burn us away. If we start thinking angry thoughts, we can start thinking angry actions as well, and that is most certainly sinful. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says God. If I can turn back to Matthew chapter 5 again, just to spend some time thinking about verse 22, where he has these three propositions. Whosoever is angry with his brother will, of course, will be in danger of the judgment. Sorry, we've looked at that one. Whosoever shall say to his brother, Raka, shall be in danger of the council, which is the second of the three. Raka, in our margin, or those of us who have margins, it says vain fellow there. And Strong gives the word as, empty one, a worthless one, or he says, whatever term of utter vilification. It is evidently a command for, to refrain from running down or berating our brethren and sisters. But I believe the words he uses here are quite serious words. Again, I don't think any of us might turn around to our brethren and sisters and say, worthless one, or empty one. But I do believe he is using these words to indicate the seriousness of not just saying such things, but thinking these things as well. And Hebrews 4 verse 12 tells us that the word of God is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. It's not just our words, but the thoughts and intents of our hearts. God knows our minds, and though our brothers and sisters may not, God is fully aware of our thinking, and whether or not our thinking is as a result of the flesh or as a result of the spirit absorbed. Whoever shall say to his brother Raka shall be in danger of the council. The council is the Greek word synedrion. And that obviously is where we get the word Sanhedrin from. Now, why did Christ choose this word? I don't think he would hardly have thought that whosoever shall say to his brother Raka should be brought before the scribes and the Pharisees, who were the Sanhedrin in his day. But perhaps the origins of the word, this Synedrion, indicates the nature of this council that he refers to. It is thought, and I don't think it can be defined with any certainty, that the derivation of the word is from sun and hedraos, which means immovable. And we, of course, know that the Son of Righteousness was immovable. We read that he set his face towards Zion. He was a rock, we might say, immovable. He knew what was before him, and he set his face towards Jerusalem. He was not to be deterred from his purpose. And likewise, his Father is a rock, immovable. And perhaps that is the indication of this word here, Synedrion, or Synedrion, an immovable council, one that it cannot be wrong, and is consistent. And of course, the word made flesh at the judgment seat will be a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. The last one then, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. A fool is the word moros, which according to Strong is dull, stupid, and absurd. And perhaps you get our word moron from this, I don't know. Again, I repeat myself, we are unlikely to call anyone any of these words. I've never heard a brother calling a brother stupid, absurd. But perhaps, again, Christ is really escalating the issue to the highest insult to try and make us aware of the enormity of maligning or berating our brethren and sisters in any form, whether to their face, behind their backs, or in our hearts. And obviously, hellfire there, we fully understand, is not the hellfire that the apostasy would have us believe. It is Gehenna, and Gehenna was the rubbish dump on the south side of Jerusalem. and a fire burnt there almost incessantly, and rubbish was thrown into it and burnt away. And he's evidently referring to the eternal damnation of those who take the attitudes condemned in these verses. Brother Grocard, in that same exhortation already quoted, says, "If you are aware that your brother has anything against you, is in any way estranged or upset, regardless of whether it is justified or not, the command of Christ is, be reconciled." And therefore we have verse 23, "Therefore if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift." The command of Christ is, be reconciled. Jesus does not discuss where the fault may lie. That is unimportant. The important part is, seek reconciliation. Continually, always. Not just go through the motions once or twice, like a technical Pharisee. He says, be reconciled. Keep at it, and never give up the effort. Of course, I'm echoing the words of Brother Dale this morning, that doesn't mean that the truth has to be compromised to be reconciled with a brother. The basis is obvious, that the truth is already pure. If the truth is impure, there can be no reconciliation. Can I turn to Proverbs chapter 21 on this subject, and verse 26, 7, sorry. Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 27. "The sacrifice of the wicked is abomination. How much more when he brings it with a wicked mind?" And perhaps Christ had the words of the Proverbs in mind when he refers to bringing a gift to the altar, when at the heart there was hate, anger, whatever, between a brother and another brother or sister, for that matter. As we are giving our bodies as living sacrifices, let us examine ourselves daily. In concluding our section on murder, reading verse 26 and 27, "Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence, till thou hast paid," verse 25, "agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence, till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing." They may seem like words of wisdom, which are almost unnecessary for us. It seems fairly obvious. But perhaps, being the privileged sons of God that we are, we might be in danger of assuming that we are somehow protected against our enemies. And ultimately we are. Brother Dale has brought that out this morning with regards to persecution. We should not fear those who can destroy the body, but him who can destroy both body and soul. Nevertheless, we may be in danger of perhaps feeling that because we are the sons of God, we have a privileged position in this dispensation. Not so. This dispensation affords us no opportunity to contest with our enemies, even if our enemies are wrong. We remember the words of Christ to Peter. To those who came to take him. "If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight." And therefore, the words of Christ perhaps can come a little closer to home with regards to agreeing with our adversaries. Moving on then to Matthew chapter 7, "Judge not that ye be not judged," verse 1. Brother Grocott says, probably no command is more often broken than this. "For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged, and with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again." Just like that cheap IT cliche which says, rubbish in, rubbish out. What we put into life, we get out. And the judgment that we level at brothers and sisters will be the same degree of judgment that will be leveled at us in the presence of the great and just judge in his second advent to the earth. The word judge is the Greek word krino, or krino. Krino, I guess. Which properly means to distinguish or to decide, either mentally or judicially, and by implication, to try and condemn, etc. And I found this particularly interesting because strong considers to decide whether mentally or judicially. And judgment is a crime or crime. Now, the interesting thing about it is that we do not have the capacity to decide. And that is why Christ condemns judgment. We do not have the capacity to be able to decide for two reasons. One, we cannot know the heart. Only God and Christ are able to do this. Nor can we know the circumstances. And the second reason is, our judgment is almost never true judgment. It is almost always colored by the thinking of the flesh. To varying degrees, truly, but it is almost always colored by the thinking of the flesh. 1 John 3, verse 20, I just had this verse regarding God and Christ, who only knows the heart. For if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart and knoweth all things. Regarding the second, regarding our judgment colored by the flesh, we read the words of Paul, who, you know, was a wonderful example to us, but even he recognized the inability of the flesh. Romans chapter 7 and verse 18, he said, "For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good things, but the will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good I find not." And these verses I brought just to support the fact that our ability to decide or sort of judge others, we do not have the capacity for that. And the problem is, with flesh, one's own set of standards becomes the benchmark for others to have to live by. We must all have seen or heard of this type of approach in ecclesias in the past, where brethren or sisters sort of get these little things which they think are right and true, and perhaps they are, and obviously we're not talking doctrines here, we're talking ways of life, and they try to enforce it on others, and we're all acutely aware that it is horrible and it is destructive of ecclesial harmony. The problem is, we are all in danger of emulating this same spirit, and to varying degrees. We know that Jehu was very capable of breaking down the images and the worship of Baal in Israel, and for that he was commended. However, he did not have the capacity to build up in the way of godliness. He was a breaker, but not a maker. And we need to remember, brothers and sisters, that we will be measured by a standard that is not of our own making. The standard that we will be judged by is, and we can be thankful for this, is not a standard that we have derived, but a standard that has been set as an example by Christ. He will pay no deference to our efforts for judging others, other than judging ourselves against his example. And Paul in 1 Corinthians 11 says, "For if we would judge ourselves, we should not be judged." Verse 3 of Matthew chapter 7, "Why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye? Consider us not the beam that is in thine own eye." I know growing up I had this wonderful picture of a man walking around with a huge beam hanging out of his eye. And I believe that Christ really is trying to drive that picture home to show the ridiculousness of the situation. And yet we so often fail to see it in ourselves. We can so easily criticize or point out the faults of others without realizing that we have either equally or even greater faults of our own. The utter illogic of such an approach is evident, but unfortunately rarely seen. And we can try pointing out the faults of others so often in what we think is in a loving attitude. We may genuinely feel that helping our brothers and sisters involves pointing out their faults. And truly, there are times when this is needed. But unfortunately, like we say, we can so often see our own faults. Human nature is so inept at seeing its own faults. It is naturally outward-looking, analysing others without analysing ourselves. Christ teaches us to be inward-looking. But perhaps his teaching goes deeper even than this, because perhaps the judgment can become, rather than a helpful approach, it can become a simple condemnation, without any intention of helping, and we are very much in danger of doing this as well. And this is double-barreled, because one, it does not help our brethren and sisters, especially if the criticism is hypocritical, and secondly, which is something we might not be acutely aware of, it elevates ourselves. And Brother Dale pointed out to us the worth of the poor in spirit and the meek believers, not those who are prepared and willing to elevate themselves. Christ will only look with any favour at those who are humble and of a contrite spirit and tremble at the word of God. James chapter 4 verse 12, another powerful. There is one lawgiver who is able to save and destroy, he says. Who art thou that judgest another? There is one lawgiver, only one. And therefore, we have no recourse to judge and criticize others. Every unnecessary critical word is a mark against us at the judgment seat. Let us be ever aware of this. We may be thoughtlessly compiling quite a formidable record for that dread day. And Romans chapter 14. Romans 14 verse 1. Him that is weak in the faith receive ye, but not to doubtful disputations. For one believeth that he may eat all things, another who is weak eateth herbs. Let not him that eateth despise him that eateth not, and let not him which eateth not judge him that eateth. For God has received him. Who art thou that judgest another man's servant? To his own master he standeth or falleth. Yea, he shall be holden up, for God is able to make him stand. And here we have a practical exhortation. There is one brother who sees one thing as wrong. It is evidently not critical things. We aren't talking here about whether one believes in the correct understanding of the nature and sacrifice of Christ or not, but one who believes that it is wrong to eat meats because of the association with idols, so he decides to eat herbs. We have no power or recourse to judge such brethren and sisters. And verse 4, who art thou that judgest another man's servant? We should look to our own lives and our own interests, and not our own interests so much, but our own walk and conduct. Backbiting also comes under this pale of judging, speaking evil of others behind their backs. We know that Brother Roberts refused even to listen to backbiting, never mind engaging in it. Despite these words, let us be ever cognizant of Christ's words in John chapter 7, in verse 24, where he says, judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment. We must not judge our brethren and sisters as far as criticizing and pointing out the little ironies are concerned. But at the same time, we cannot ignore our responsibilities as stewards of God's truth. We must be wise as serpents and harmless as doves, so to speak. We must not condemn, but we must recognize that out of 6.5 billion people in this world, there are but a very small few who we are afforded the pleasure of friendship with. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 iterates this point. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God. As God hath said, I will dwell in them, and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord. And touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you. And will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord God Almighty. Here, we are commanded to judge between believers and unbelievers. We are commanded to carry out an element of judgment in who we can and who we cannot acquaint ourselves with, which is obvious enough in ourselves, but it's unfortunately not always so simple. In 1923, we know that a large body of believers in the truth saw no need to distance themselves from error, and consequently became unequally yoked together with unbelievers. And so we must be discerning. We must always be ready to denounce error and wrongdoing, whilst never judging, or maybe use that word, deciding a brother or sister's integrity and faithfulness. Judge not, that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. The Apocalypse chapter 22 says, Behold, I come quickly, and my reward is with me, to give unto every man according as his work shall be. If our work has been judging and condemning, then our reward will be to be judged and condemned before Christ and all his holy angels. I want to close with one of the snippets of Brother Grocott. Do not take your ecclesia for granted. Labour constantly for its health and welfare. The truth itself is eternal and indestructible. But in these days of the flesh and of weakness, the ecclesia is a fragile thing needing constant attending and care. Ecclesias flourish and ecclesias languish. Ecclesias live and ecclesias die. Ecclesias grow and ecclesias shrivel. The difference may be you. The health of the ecclesia depends on the spirit of the ecclesia, the oneness, the unity, the closeness, the mutual affection and care of the members one for another. A body is not healthy until all parts are alive and active and working. The ecclesia is a body with many members. All are necessary. All have full-time work to do to make the ecclesia a true, living, spiritual, divine entity, united to God, while pleasing to God, steadily moving forward and upward to eventual, perfect, eternal oneness with God. Make the ecclesia's welfare and harmony and spirituality and mutually upbuilding your joy, your constant prayer and care. Help, strengthen, encourage, support, serve. Subdue your flesh and all your fleshly reactions. Subdue your natural antagonisms and criticisms and petty, small-minded frictions. All these things are destructive of ecclesial well-being. Forget yourself, especially your baby grievances, and work wholly for the common good. Herein alone will you find peace and joy and fulfillment.